Hi there. I'm Jean Godfrey June, and this is Megan O'Neill.
And we are the beauty editors at Goop.
And you're listening to Goop's podcast series, The Beauty Closet. We talk about all things beauty, clean, non-toxic beauty, skin care, hair care, body care, self-care. And we talk about the way we think about beauty, both as individuals and as a wider culture.
Our guest today is super impressive. God, she was incredible to talk to.
Dr. Helen Fisher is an anthropologist who specializes in the biology of love and attraction.
She studies love. What a job. I love that she exists. She's also a senior research fellow at the Kinsey Institute and chief scientific advisor to Match.com.
She's written 6 books on sex, love, marriage, and how your personality type shapes who you fall in love with and who you're attracted to. And we're going to talk about beauty and how that plays into love and attraction, because I think in our culture we tend to think it's everything. If you're beautiful, you'll have a perfectly wonderful love life and everybody else's sucks, and we all know
good point.
Nothing to do with reality. But what does, you know, what role beauty has is interesting.
Yeah. Let's hear what she has to say.
We wanted to know, first of all, just how you first got interested in love and attraction within anthropology, mm-hmm. and then what you've become today, how that evolved. But what originally made you realize, oh, this is the part of anthropology, I guess, probably little studied before you?
That's a wonderful question, and I wish I had a sexy answer. But actually, my answer is that I'm an identical twin. Oh. And even as a small child, they always ask identical twins the same questions. Do you have the same cavities in your teeth? Do you have the same friends? Do you think alike? Et cetera, et cetera. And so long before I knew there was a nature-nurture controversy, I knew that some of my behavior had a biological origin. And wow. Then while I was getting my PhD, everybody kept telling me, oh, the mind is an empty slate, and environment just inscribes your personality, and I knew it wasn't true. And so when it came time for my PhD dissertation, I began to think, if there's any part at all of human behavior that would have some biological origins, it would be our reproductive patterns. Because mm-hmm. as Darwin said, if you have 4 children and I have no children, you live on and I die mm-hmm. out. So I began to think, these behaviors make a difference on the biological spectrum. So I began to think, okay, well, I'm going to study what could be the only behavior patterns, you know, in the human animal that have some biological origins. So my first study was why we bother to form pair bonds. I mean, you know, 97% of mammals do not pair up to rear their young. People do. And then that led me into, well, what is it in the brain that drives you to fall for this person and that person? And, well, how do you feel when you're madly in love? And so then I came to the idea that we've evolved 3 distinctly different brain systems for mating and reproduction: sex drive, feelings of intense romantic love, mm-hmm. and feelings of deep attachment. So that was the beginning of it. You know, a lot of people assume that somebody like me just had a terrible love affair in high school, and they've got to figure it out. And you didn't?
No, I definitely didn't. No.
Good for you.
But I didn't guess the identical twin.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting that, nobody gets out of love alive, you know. We all have our problems. But the bottom line is, that's not what spurred me to do this.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Today, as far as what you're most interested right now and what your day-to-day, what you're focusing on, is there a particular question within that that's got your attention?
I've got a lot of them. You know, when you study love, there's just so many parts to it. I get an email from somebody around the world every single day. I mean, recently I got one from Angola. I mean, for God's sakes,
wow.
Angola. there's 2 main things that I do. You know, I am chief science advisor to Match.com, the internet dating site. And so I do an annual study with them called Singles in America. And in that study, I make up about 200 questions every year, and we poll about a little over 5,000 singles. So we've done it for 9 years. I've got data on over 45,000 Americans. It's not people, not the Match members. It's a representative sample based on the U.S. Census, so we got the right number of blacks, whites, Asians, mm-hmm. Latino, gay, straight, rural, suburban, urban, every part of the country and every age group, age 18 to 71 plus. Thousands and thousands of data points to see, you know, to get to the lifeblood of the American singles and what they feel about sex and love.
Wow.
And how many orgasms they have. And the other thing is, probably even more interesting to me at the moment is personality and why you fall in love with one person rather than another. And I created a questionnaire that has now been taken by over 14 million people in 40 countries.
We took it.
And you did?
Yes, we did.
Oh, how wonderful.
It's so fun.
What did you?
I made my boyfriend take it too.
Oh, terrific. I mean, it's the only one in the world. It started from an understanding of brain circuitry to make a questionnaire. And then I went on to do two fMRI brain scanning studies to validate it. So what did you end up being? Do you happen to remember?
Yeah, I was a negotiator. And I was attracted, really? That makes sense. I was attracted to directors.
Yeah, so you have a lot of the traits of high estrogen, and so do I. And that style of thinking is regularly drawn to their opposite, the high testosterone, which is the director. And how about you?
Well, I was also a negotiator drawn to the director. Yeah. And I think I was explorer next, but I had a negotiator. And my boyfriend was also a negotiator.
Really?
A negotiator.
That's interesting.
Is that rare?
There's nothing really rare, but
he had a lot of director, though.
He did as well. So. And that's what's really interesting, Jean, that we are a combination of all of them. This is why one of the reasons that I object to so many other of these Myers-Briggs and all the rest of them is that they put you in a bucket. And the brain is not a bucket. You know, it is ratios upon ratios and combinations about combinations. So you sound like you are a negotiator explorer. You express more of the traits of the estrogen and the dopamine system. How about you, Megan?
I was dopamine.
Yeah. Oh, dopamine too. Both.
Yes.
So this is one of the reasons that as soon as you walked in, I felt connected more to you. I'm beginning to feel, I mean, I almost chemically feel, you know, I mean, I have friends who are very high serotonin, but it's a little more work for me because they're more traditional, conventional, follow the rules, respect authority, you know, concrete rather than theoretical thinkers. And that's good. And we need those people.
We need every kind of person.
We need it
for
all.
Sure.
But I don't feel as rapidly connected to the kind of person that they are. So, and like you, I'm very high estrogen and very high dopamine and explorer, negotiator. And my boyfriend is very high dopamine, like me, and that type is drawn to each other. Is your boyfriend high dopamine?
I can't remember if he was, his biggest things were director and negotiator.
That's an unusual thing.
They were close, too, in the numbers.
He's a musician, is that?
He's
make
a musician.
A
that's higher testosterone. What kind of musician?
Guitar, like electric guitar. So that's testosterone.
Interesting.
Because with long hair.
That's a fine motor coordination with that guitar.
True.
So that's more estrogen. Musical ability is linked with the testosterone system in both men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And what is music? But it's spatial. It's very spatial.
Yeah, true.
It's not spatial to me. I can barely add. I'm not, you know, I'm math, but
we're all in agreement here at this table.
But it's rather structural, music is. And I've always had men who said, "Oh, you can't see where it changes the beat." Well, yeah, I can. I guess I can, but I'm just swinging to the beat. Whereas they see the whole structure of it, which is testosterone. So,
yeah, sort of mathy at some level.
Yeah.
Well, because we're beauty editors, we're always looking at the surface.
Good.
And you're famous for establishing these, you know, these four different brain types and what goes on once people have met after they've been on Match.com, after they've, you know, gotten together. But are there surfacey things that we know affect attraction?
Absolutely. And they're not so surface. I mean, for example, you know, Aristotle thought that there were some universal signals of beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the main ones that he said, and anthropologists still abide by, is symmetry in both men and women. And it's so interesting. I mean, even in other species, I mean, there's a little fly, the scorpion fly, who the females go for a male with symmetrical wings. you know, the barn swallow is attracted to symmetrical tail feathers. Monkeys are attracted to an individual with symmetrical teeth. And we are attracted to symmetrical faces and symmetrical bodies. And there's a reason for it. I mean, lopsidedness has been associated with, you know, collecting more bacteria and more viruses, et cetera.
Huh, really?
And symmetry has been associated with a stronger immune system. So we've evolved this drive for attraction to symmetry in the face and body probably because we don't know it, but we're attracted to people with a stronger immune system.
Yeah.
And that is very adaptive. So, and there's many other signals. I mean, we are, you know, walking billboards. The outside says a lot about the inside.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, you probably know about the waist to hip ratio.
Yes.
And the fact that, you know, around the world, apparently, men are more attracted to a woman whose waist is about 70% of their hips.
Right.
And, I mean, people say, oh, you know, that's superficial. It isn't. Apparently, women who have that particular ratio of waist to hips get pregnant more easily, have fewer miscarriages.
So it indicates something.
It indicates fertility.
Health-wise, yeah.
So does everything attract that we think is attractive indicate health and fertility at the end of the day?
I would say not everything. I mean, I do think that different cultures have some, you know, some simply cultural mechanisms. I mean, I think there's a lot of... I have a friend on the West Coast who doesn't understand why I'm always wearing black.
Yeah, my mom never, she's from the West Coast.
Yeah, and that's just the same country. I mean, if you went to India or you went to Nepal or you went to parts of Alaska or among the Inuit, I think you would find some differences. I mean, now, for example, the Maori, do a lot of tattooing on the face.
Yeah.
And most Americans would not regard that as beautiful.
Right.
So I do think that there are some genetically, we're predisposed genetically to respond to certain kinds of beauty, which are universal.
Right.
And there's other forms of beauty that are culturally developed.
Okay. And speaking about tattooing on the face, what about hair and makeup? Like, is what do you think is more important when it comes to attraction?
Hair or makeup?
Yeah.
Well, we don't even know why we have this long hair on our I'm an anthropologist. I mean, why do we have this long hair? I mean, chimpanzees and gorillas and orangutans, they don't grow long hair on their head.
True.
And so,
hair is such a thing, you know, like
it expresses status. I mean, what happens when a woman goes into the armed forces? The first thing is the hair is cut to express your status. And what about very long hair, particularly on a man, is an expression, a statement of, I'm not going the corporate route, et cetera. And, women with purple hair are saying, I'm not going with the going
either.
Fashion.
Right.
And so these are expressions, I think, of status and group, tribal group. I mean, I do think that an awful lot of face makeup. Now, if you're wearing black lipstick, I think it's more of an expression, and you guys might know this more than me, but... black lipstick is going to say, I don't give a damn about what you're doing.
Right.
I'm different. I'm alternative, et cetera. But an awful lot of facial makeup is basically to look more symmetrical. Hmm. I mean, make the lips symmetrical, to make the eyes look symmetrical, to get rid of blemishes on the face that may show disease or lack of symmetry. So I do think that it's a combination of style, and which is probably cultural.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And biological, which is playing on the human universal for symmetry,
both
of them.
What about lipstick? Like, don't you feel like men are always complaining about how they don't like lipstick, red lipstick specifically?
Well, I don't blame them. I mean, I really wouldn't want to. I mean, I happen to be a woman who likes a man, but the bottom line is I'm not sure I'd want to go towards a woman who's full of what they might regard as goo. And also it gets all over them. Then they got to go and get it off.
Maybe they want to see for themselves whether the person is symmetrical.
Exactly.
That's the desire.
A really good point. They want to see the natural symmetry. They want to see the real thing.
Yeah. Because people often get up, but she's wearing makeup, and that, it's like this sort of negative thing.
She's
and maybe
cheating.
it's you want to see the real person underneath.
So it's really interesting. So I one of my years in my Singles in America study with Match, I asked, when you're out dating with somebody and you've started spending the night and all that, when do you begin to not wear makeup in the morning?
And do they say
they do. I don't remember the answer, but it took me a long time with this present man to I didn't get up and put it on, but as soon as I could.
Really? With all
you know, Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's still an instinctual.
You're courting the boy.
Right, yeah.
And courtship is important. I mean, Match never likes me to say this, but, you know, courtship is not about honesty. Courtship is about winning. It's about winning.
It's about getting in there.
Yeah, and you know, I've watched 40,000 people, both men and women, lie. Mm-hmm. You know, men will lie about their height.
Yeah.
And how much money they're making. Women will lie about their weight and how old they are. I mean, these are standard lies.
Yeah, yes.
But then, I mean, with all kinds of beauty, I mean, we buy clothes that make our figure more symmetrical and more attractive. You know, a cinching belt, a shorter skirt, a plunging neckline, a certain jewelry to advertise our background, our educational level, the groups we hang around with. I mean, we are, as I say, a walking billboard for courtship.
And actually dialing back even further in the the match.com process, are there any things about photographs that you guys have like that are more successful in
Absolutely.
Terms of presenting yourself, like, what, you know, female or male?
Well, you know, whatever gender. It's always been that if men with an animal, particularly a dog, is quite appealing to women. I mean, what is a dog? It's something you've got to take responsibility for. I mean, you've got to get home on time. You've got to walk it. You've got to take it to the vet when it's sick, et cetera, et cetera. So that seems to be a real magnet.
I feel like I would think it was cheesy if a guy had a dog in his picture.
Depends if he likes dogs. I've seen men who put dogs in when they don't like dogs. That's cheating. But I've seen a lot of people cheat. You know, they'll say, I love sailing or I love golf, when in fact they don't love sailing or golf. They just want the boy.
They want who does love sailing and golf.
They want somebody. And they figure once you've fallen madly in love with them, they will overlook it. I have a wonderful girlfriend who, you know, pretended she liked fishing. And her would-be husband pretended that he loved opera. And only after they really got together did they realize she couldn't stand to go fish, and he really hated the opera.
Oh, that's a weird question that we were talking about. This the phenomenon of, you know, you're in a long-term relationship, and, like, you know, one person gets their hair cut and the other person doesn't notice it, that kind of thing. How important, you know, a lot of your studies are about how we get along and how we, you know, why we're with the person we're with. How much sort of, like, maintenance, outside beautifying, you know, where people, if they're going on a new date every couple of weeks or whatever, they're going to be dressing themselves up and whatever. And how important is that in a long-term relationship? And what is the phenomenon where the person can't see it anymore as much?
I think it's much more important than people think. I mean, I think in a long-term partnership, it's very valuable to sustain all three of these basic brain systems: sex drive, feelings of intense romantic love, and feelings of deep attachment. And, you know, people start wearing their sweatpants and, you know, a dirty sweater. And I think it's a mistake.
And they're just focusing on attachment, not,
you know, they're not really taking the other person into. And so, you know, it's actually, this happened to me last Saturday night. Now, I've been hanging around with my guy for almost 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I had gotten into wearing the sweatpants. We were going to cook dinner, watch a really good movie, and have a lovely night at home.
Yeah.
And I looked into my bureau and I saw two shirts there, both rather expensive shirts. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I would never wear these around other people because they're a little too sexy. Why don't I put it on for him?
Yeah.
While I'm cooking, and one was white. Mm-hmm. Well, that could get destroyed while you're cooking. I said, it's going to sit in the drawer, Helen, or you're going to put this thing on and look good for him. Because it was comfortable. You got to pick things that are really comfortable.
Yeah, you can't be
that,
like,
you can be
around
in
the kitchen and
exactly,
or
in stilettos. Forget it. But I do think that you should continue the courtship process. And people will say to me, well, you mean you don't trust him? Well, I do trust him. But, you know, I think it's very valuable to sustain all three of these brain systems. And the way to do it among them is to look attractive. And, I mean, I put some makeup on and he noticed it. And that shirt's a little worse for wear.
but
I wasn't going to wear it outside the home anyway. So where am I coming from? You know,
right.
Yeah. I do think it's very valuable to sustain romance in a long-term partnership. And it is possible. You know, we don't believe, Americans don't believe that you can remain in love with somebody long term. Mm. And they think that it just migrates into attachment and that early fluttering stage just vanishes. Well, we've proven that you can sustain intense romantic love, not just loving somebody, but sustaining real romantic romance long term. But A, you got to pick the right person. Mm-hmm. And B, you've got to sustain all three of these brain systems. And so I would get rid of the clothes that are really ugly so that you're not even tempted to wear them.
That is good.
Unless he's
know.
Out of town for 3 weeks. Yeah. You know?
So you do have to try. Yeah. Not just try, but
and
you have
men
to.
Men have to try too.
Right.
You know, I think if the woman, whoever initiates it, the other's going to get the perspective and maybe do it. And we don't show up in those kind of clothes when we go out with our girlfriends, you know, or when we go to work. I mean, what is important in life? But, you know, it's very interesting. I once read a quote. I can't remember who it's by. It could have been Shaw. But he basically said, so whoever it was, he said, the most important thing you can do for your children is love your partner. So that they see that, you know, beauty around them. And part of that is playing the part, just, you know, sustaining your own good looks.
I like that.
Getting back more to the sort of the studies with people who are dating, you've talked about in a couple of places the paradox of choice and that maybe that was something that super attractive people have always had, but now it's sort of at everyone's fingertips. How do you think that's changed attraction, or has it?
You can't change the brain system for romantic love. I and my colleagues have put over 100 people into a brain scanner, and this brain system for romantic love lies way below the cortex where you do your thinking, way below the limbic regions in the middle of the brain that orchestrate the emotions, in a little factory near the very base of the brain that is linked with drive. Romantic love is a drive. It's like the fear system or the anger system. It's not going to change. In fact, it lies right next to the factory that orchestrates thirst and hunger. Thirst and hunger keep you alive today. Romantic love drives you to make a pair bun and drive your DNA into tomorrow. So the bottom line is you can't change it. But courtship is changing.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, in hunting and gathering societies, I mean, I'm an anthropologist, you only had a few choices in your life. Mm-hmm. These days, we have too many choices. There's nothing really wrong with these dating sites. They're not even dating sites, as far as I'm concerned. They're introducing sites. The only real algorithm is your own brain. But bottom line is, these days, as you say, it's the paradox of choice. The brain has basically a sweet spot of between 5 and 9 choices. After you are confronted with more than 9 choices, you begin to choose nobody at all.
Right.
The brain is swamped. And so one of the things that I say is, okay, it's a new form of courtship, all these choices. The only way to handle it is after you've met 9 people, not just talked with 9 people, but met.
Actually met.
9 people, stop. Get off the dating site and get to know at least one of these people better. Because the brain is built to, the more you get to know somebody, the more you like them, and the more you think that they are like you. So there's nothing wrong with these introducing sites. We just don't know how to use them. And we've got too many alternatives, and we need to spend some time just getting to know one of at least 9 people that we've met. And the other thing I say to people is, you know, the brain is built to say no. There's huge brain region, huge brain region linked with what they call negativity bias. We remember the negative. And for good Darwinian reasons. I mean, for millions of years, it was nice to remember how much your friends liked you. But if you forgot your enemies, you could die.
Right.
So we are built to remember the negative. And so when you go out with somebody on that first date and, you know, they were pretty cool. And you remember one stupid thing that they said. Mm-hmm. And it's over.
And it sticks.
And so I say, try, you know, some positive illusions. Try to overlook that one negative. If it works at all. I mean, if the person is 40 years older and 2 feet tall and you're 7 feet tall, forget about it. I mean, it's not going to work. But the bottom line, if they fall within what I call your love map, your unconscious list, and conscious list of what you're looking for in a partner, if you fall within that at all, try to overlook the negative, focus on the positive, and go out on a second date and get to know the person better. It's called positive illusions, yeah. And by the way, that's what really works in long-term partnerships. I really wanted to know, what makes long-term happiness in a relationship? I mean, you've picked the right person, and psychologists will tell you a lot of things. They'll say, and they're all good. I mean, don't show contempt, don't threaten divorce, listen actively, all good. But what does the brain say about long-term happiness? So we put some people in the brain scanner who were in, maintaining they were still in love long-term. We proved that they were. And we looked at those who scored very high on a happiness scale. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, those people who are in long-term partnerships, average 21 years, all happily married, most of them had adult children, et cetera, all in their 50s and 60s, and we found three brain regions linked with long-term happiness. A brain region linked with empathy, a brain region linked with controlling your own stress and your own emotions, and a third brain region linked with positive illusions. That brain region linked with negativity bias began to reduce its activity. And we call that positive illusion. So these people in long-term partnerships were overlooking the negative, being empathetic, and controlling their own stress.
Wow.
These are basic concepts of how the brain builds happiness.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me, too.
That, yeah. Oof.
Can we talk about super attractive people? Because you have some interesting research on how people react around certain...
There's a piece in The Atlantic that you, where you were talking
about.
What did
I say?
You were saying that there were some negatives.
Yeah. The urge isn't necessarily to act on that they're attractive, but you feel awkward and, you know, your instinct is to... Your impulse is to not go towards the attractive person.
I do think that extremely attractive people have some problems because everybody seems to go for them. And they're not quite sure what's real. And
it's like someone who's very rich and thinks.
Exactly. When you look at somebody who's very attractive, it's called the ventral tegmental area, and the left ventral tegmental area, you got one on the left hemisphere and the right. Those people who were very attractive activated in the people looking at them, activity in the left ventral tegmental area. So what they were doing is pumping out the people. When you look at somebody who's very attractive, even in a crowd, you're walking down the street, Madison Avenue, whatever, you see 30 people coming towards you and you see somebody who's very attractive.
So good.
more than likely, would you say?
I said, so good.
Yeah. Activity in this left ventral tegmental area will become activated, pump out the dopamine, and they feel pleasure. Now, they might want to keep walking. They've got a girlfriend or a boyfriend they're in love with. But the brain responds to people who are very attractive. And so I think that these people have some trouble. I remember years ago, I was in graduate school, and I went out for several years with a man who was strikingly good looking. I mean, he was boring as hell. My God, I finally got rid of him. And we would go to a party, and women just glommed onto him.
Oh, my God.
And it just... was not good for him. Hmm. He did not know who was real and who wasn't real. And he would come home with me, and we lived together, and he'd say, I don't know why she came on to me so strong. She doesn't even know me. And we would laugh about it. And so, I mean, I don't, it can be a bug, and it can be a perk. I mean, it can be a wonderful perk. But very good looking people end up going out and marrying very good looking people. I mean, that is the data. We tend to end up partnering within our general level of good looks. And, of course, one of the problems with men who go out with a very good-looking woman have to spend their lives protecting, you know, protecting from other men.
I have a friend who goes out. She is married to a very attractive man, like just crazily attractive. And she's always she always feels like she's defending. Like she'll go in the bathroom and, you know, at some like dinner and all the people will be like, did you see that guy? And she's just like,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
And you know, I once went out a little while for a man who was once again, strikingly good looking. And he was a lawyer. And he told me this story about, you know, various clients would come in and they would expect him to be the guy pouring the coffee.
Oh, instead of the like guy, a good-looking
right.
guy.
Yeah, a good-looking intern as opposed to an intelligent man. So, I mean, I'm not going to... all things considered, it would be more fun to be better looking. So I'm not gonna, you know, it's like people who went to Harvard or Yale. Yeah, I don't feel like, sorry for them.
I don't feel sorry for you.
But bottom line is, it could have its bad parts too.
This is an anecdotal observation, but I still have it. Maybe there's research that bears it out, but like, man, maybe there isn't. But super attractive people, the male people I know who are super attractive are generally the male people who have I know who have had the most sex, you know.
Yes.
And women, the most attractive women I know are not the women that I know who've had the most sex.
The data shows that men who are super attractive tend to have sex 4 years earlier than more lopsided, less mm-hmm. symmetrical men. They tend to have more sex partners. Women tend to have more orgasms with men who are very symmetrical, which means
really?
Good looking.
Wow.
And
who
they
knew?
Suck up more of their sperm. So
wait, what do you mean? What do you mean suck up more of their
like
sperm?
They'll actually like...
Is that true?
It's not my research. It is in my book, Anatomy
of Love.
Well,
I'm sure it's true. I'm just shocked. Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah. Well...
So your body's like, I want to get with this.
More symmetrical people tend to have higher immune systems. They probably get better jobs. They probably make more money.
It's like devastating, you know,
we're in the reproductive business. Though. I mean, we all are in the business of finding the healthiest partner to help us raise our babies.
Yeah.
And very symmetrical men tend to have these perks
yeah.
that women are not even aware of.
Does it seem
and
like...
And then it doesn't work the other way?
Well, don't forget there's other forms of beauty. I mean, somebody who's got true. A wonderful sense of humor, somebody who's just very... You know, a very good dancer, absolutely charming conversationalist, you know, shares all of your interests. I mean, there's other forms of beauty than just physically what you look like.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is a very symmetrical woman, you know, it's easier to get pregnant, you know, conceives faster, is less likely to have a miscarriage, is less likely to have diabetes or hypertension or even some heart disease or even some cancers. So, when a man sees a woman who's very symmetrical, he's not just going out with her beauty.
You said that race and religion can play less of a role than we might expect.
Yeah,
it's very interesting.
Attraction?
You know, I do these Singles in America studies with Match. And what's interesting is we are less interested in a status. As a matter of fact, there's only two things that scientists now know that these introducing services, dating services, have really changed. Mm-hmm. And one of them is we're seeing more interracial relationships and marriages. And it's because people are less interested in race and more interested in a real companion. Now, I've been reading Trollope and other, you know, I mean, geez, 200 years ago, even 150 years ago, you had to marry within your class. You had to marry, women had to marry not only within their class, and within their social status, of the same religion and background, of the social networks, and somebody who made a lot of money. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how many people complain today about, oh, I can't find anybody. You know, I tell you, it is the easiest time in human evolution to marry outside of your class, outside of your religion, outside of your social group, with somebody who is just looking for a companion. When I, every single time in this Singles in America study, I ask, what are you looking for?
Mm-hmm.
And every single year, something like 86% of singles are looking for a companion. I once asked, you know, are you looking for financial status? Only 16% said yes. You know, as women rise economically, we see the rise of the double income family. We see more and more men and women wanting somebody of the same interests and companionship. They are less and less interested in background. Now, we still tend to fall for somebody from the same socioeconomic background, same general level of intelligence, same general level of good looks. But that's probably because we mill around with people of that variety rather than because, you know, we have as much. So in America, a lot of people would say that, well, we're in a very bad time. I mean, more and more people are dividing us up politically. They're dividing us up. But in terms of love, what I see, and it's solid data, we're seeing more and more interracial relationships and a look, and both men and women seeking for a genuine companion rather than somebody with a lot of money or somebody who's very good looking.
Do you think online, these online dating platforms have spurred that, because you see every type of person, and, you know, back in the day you sort of saw who was around you in your bubble?
I think that's definitely part of it. And I think that there's also a big general shift towards, we're now allowed to date outside our socioeconomic class and background, mm-hmm. et cetera. But it's very interesting. These two, there's only two things that we know that these dating services really have contributed to. I mean, we'll find others, but bottom line is we're seeing more interracial marriages. That's number one. And we're seeing, there's one article out of the University of Chicago that shows that we're seeing more stable marriages. And I thought to myself, now how can that be?
Yeah.
I mean, why would it make any difference whether you met somebody on the internet as opposed to meeting them at church or meeting them at the zoo or meeting them in a museum or meeting them on a park bench? Why would that make any difference? So I did a study with Match, and we compared people who date on the internet, not just Match, but anywhere on the internet, as opposed to people who date off the internet. And as it turns out, people who date on the internet rather than off the internet, those people who date on the internet had three qualities. They were more likely to have a full-time job. They were more likely to be a higher educated, and they were more likely to be looking for commitment. So, on the internet these days, you're more likely to find somebody with those characteristics.
My God.
Those characters are linked with stability.
Wow. Yeah. That is interesting.
As a matter of fact, you know, we ask every year at Match, where did you meet your last first date? And every year it varies somewhat, but year before last, 40% said that they had met their last first date on the internet, and only 25% had met through a friend, and only between less than 10%, about 6%, 8% had met in a bar. These people, these days everybody goes to a bar, but you meet your girlfriends in the bar and you go on Tinder.
Right. Totally. Yeah, that's very true.
You don't meet the people in the bar.
So true.
The reason I'm not surprised is that I wrote an article recently called Slow Love. I'm very optimistic about the future, because what we're seeing now is we're married much later. What we're really seeing is the extension of the pre-commitment stage, where we used to marry somebody we met in high school or in college. We're married much later, in our late 20s, even early 30s. And so I call it slow love. And what we're doing is this long pre-commitment stage in which we're getting to know who we are, we're getting to know who our partners are, we're getting rid of what we don't want, so that by the time we walk down the aisle, we know who we got, and we think we can keep who we've got. So what we're really seeing is, during this extension of the pre-commitment stage, 70% of people who have a one-night stand actually knew that person for some time. We're moving from just friends into friends with benefits. Then we're moving slowly out to telling friends and family. Then we're having our official first date, not in the beginning, but after we've had sex with the person. And then we're slowly moving into living together. And then by the time you walk down the aisle, you know who you got. So I began to think to myself, well, if we're seeing this long period of pre-commitment, maybe we're going to see more stable marriages. So I did a study of 1,100 married people, and I asked them a lot of questions. But one of the questions was, would you remarry the person that you're currently married to?
That's a good question.
81% said yes.
Wow.
So
that's a huge number.
Yeah. Now, we're never going to have completely stable marriages.
Yeah.
But I think we're moving towards relative family stability because we're marrying so much later. I mean, marriage used to be the beginning of a partnership. Now it's the finale.
Yeah.
And we're learning so much more before we wed the person. So I'm really impressed with millennials. These people want to get it right. They are cautious. They might have their one-night stands, but I did another study with Match, and 4 months into a relationship, they want that DTR, define the relationship. And
DTR.
Then
they, you know that one.
You never heard that one?
No.
Oh, wow. It's a wonderful one.
I've heard DTF.
What's that? Oh, define the
can I say it? Down to F, you know?
Oh, in other words, you
I'm
have
down
the,
to. I'm, yeah. I'm ready to.
You're ready to. Well, you're apparently it's 6 days, between 3 to 6 days. I can't imagine that takes 4 months. I think they're true, doing yeah. that before then, to be honest. And you know what? I mean, people, something like 34% of singles have had sex before they ever had the official first date. And people think that's weird. But these days, singles, I mean, you learn a lot between the sheets.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not just how they make love. You learn, are they patient? Yeah. Do they have a sense of humor? Can they listen? Mm-hmm. Are they kind? And an awful lot of singles, they're not scared of getting pregnant. They know how to handle that. They're not scared of disease. They know how to handle that. They don't have to walk the walk of shame. So really, I think that, you know, that one night stand is almost a sex interview.
I have, so one of my best friends, she makes a point, she's getting married now, but she made a point for years of sleeping with whoever she was dating on the first date, because she said she could find out pretty much everything from that mm-hmm. and decide so if good. She wanted to continue.
It's, you know, when I ask, most of them say between the third and sixth date. By the sixth date, you sleep with the person and you find out. Yes, I am impressed with millennials. One third of people in their 20s are still living at home, not because they're lazy, because they're saving their money. One wow. third of singles in their 20s want to get their finances in order before they're serious. 40% of them want to acquire self-acceptance, whatever that means, before they get into a relationship. They are preparing themselves. Sure, they have the one-night stands, but they get rid of what they want pretty rapidly and go on to look for something else. I just think that a lot of people in America will say, well, it's just reckless. They're just sleeping around. That sleeping around has a purpose. They are. I mean, I'm not suggesting it, to each his own, but the bottom line is this slow love. They're figuring it out before they get into something they can't get out of. They don't want to, quote unquote, catch feelings until they feel that there's something to happen here.
Well, I read something that maybe a study you were talking about that was about people in hookups, and that a one night stand kind of thing, that like 50% of both men and women were actually looking for something more of a relationship, even though they were having this one night stand. Yeah. I thought that was kind of
amazing. Was done by a very close friend of mine, Justin Garcia, who's now director of the Kinsey Institute, and he and I worked together, read a lot of papers on it. Yeah, you know, having sex with somebody requires a lot of energy. It requires time, and it's not very safe. And so the willingness to do this has got to have some premeditative thing. You know, sex is serious, and you're collecting data. Yeah, so no, casual sex is not casual. So either they're doing the sex interview, or they're trying to trigger this brain circuitry for romantic love. So they sort of like the person. And, you know, when you get into bed with somebody, any stimulation of the genitals can drive up the dopamine system and push you over the threshold into falling in love.
And for men and women?
Men and women, absolutely. Equally? Men fall in love faster than women do. They fall in love more often than women do. When men are the more fragile sex when it comes to romance. When men fall for somebody, they want to introduce that person to friends and family sooner. They want to move in sooner. And men are 2.5 times more likely to kill themselves when a relationship is over.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Men are a little bit more fragile than women are when it comes to romance.
I would not have guessed
that. Yeah, I would have so not guessed that.
Well, they try not to advertise it because it makes them vulnerable.
Less vulnerable.
Yeah.
Is there anything about, you know, there's a lot of, you know, I certainly feel in my life, but it's a thing people say also that you gain perspective as you get older. And certainly I know people in their 20s will be like, do I need to get Botox? You know, they're like,
God, isn't that a shame?
Yeah, but to me, it's a reflection of, I remember, you know, being young and being like, I've got to, you know, get rid of every blemish. I've got to look perfect in a way that has changed. And I'm like, you know, if someone's going to like me, they're going to like me.
Changes,
if they're not, they're
older.
Not. Yeah, it's got, as I've gotten older, you sort of get a perspective where you're a little more self-accepting, which you mentioned earlier. Mm. Is there any biological reason for that? Is there, like, I remember telling my friends in high school being like, you guys, we don't have to do our nails. If a guy's going to like you, he's going to like you with the nails or without. You mm-hmm. know, and I thought I was, you know, so yeah, brilliant.
That's a good question.
The, you know, there's sort of the micro details that you, particularly, I mean, women I know, when we're younger, we really obsess. Mm-hmm. And then it
cellulite.
Seems, yeah, cellulite. Yeah. You know, he's not going to like me if I have cellulite. And, it, you know, you get older and you're kind of like, look at they liked me and yeah, I had all these flaws.
True.
I'm not positive it is true. I mean, I'm older and I think that women keep worrying. As a matter of fact, I did one study. I really loved it. I love the question. With these two questions, I mean, the questions was, would you make a long-term commitment to somebody who had everything you were looking for, but you were not in love with them? The other question was, would you make a long-term commitment to somebody who had everything you were looking for, but you did not find them sexually attractive? The least likely to compromise were people over 60.
Ooh.
The most likely to compromise were people of reproductive age.
Oh,
because, wow. Now, for example, I mean, I'm over 60. You know, there was this guy that really liked me for a while in Arizona. And I liked him very much. But I was not in love with him and I didn't find him sexy. Would I move from New York City, where I know everybody that I like and all this stuff, to Arizona? No. Uh-uh. I wouldn't do it. If I was 22, I might. Mm-hmm. Because I or 32.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if he's the right kind of guy to support my babies and all that kind of stuff, I might choose it. So the young are probably more anxious. But, you know, I study romantic love. And when you're madly in love with somebody, not only do brain regions linked with intense romantic love become active, but brain regions linked with anxiety. Am I too fat? Why did I say that? How come I should have done that? You become anxious. But you know, I mean, any time that you're madly in love with somebody, I think at any age, people get very anxious when they're madly in love with somebody. I think it comes along with anxiety.
Yeah, maybe to, as you were saying, it's good to have it in a long-term relationship where you're a little bit anxious.
That's a beautiful thing to say. I agree.
It's good, you're saying, to have that.
Yeah, to make sure so, that,
make
you
sure
know,
you try.
Yeah,
you make sure you wear something
put on your
decent
sexy
when you're
top
at home.
To cook, your white top.
A
to
little
cook
perfume,
in.
Exactly. A little mascara here and there.
Well, that may be going
it's all
over
about
the
beauty.
But at least get rid of the dirty sweatpants and wear a decent pair of tights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, and a shirt that fits.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, well,
you're
thank
such
you.
A champion of love, even though you dissect it. That's so cool.
Well, yeah. It's so interesting, though. You know, you can know an awful lot of love and just make the same old mistakes. Although I have learned, I've learned a lot. But you know, I mean, people will say, "Well, how do you handle it?" And I say, "Well, you know, it's a little like a piece of chocolate cake. You can be a cook and know every ingredient of that piece of chocolate cake, but then when you sit down and eat it, you feel the same old joy." That everybody else does. So that's the way
it's
I
very
am.
True.
All I can think about is the sweatpants thing.
Me
too. The being schlumpy at home. That like how you shouldn't, like that, you know, you should like dress up
you
for your partner.
Try.
You should wear like inappropriate outfits that you wouldn't wear outside the house. And I'm like, what inappropriate outfit can I wear?
Yeah. I like don't have one. And I get home and I change into my saggy, baggy sweatpants.
Yeah. Well, so does my, I mean, I do. And my boyfriend does
who
also.
Doesn't?
Like, and then you're like, if the other person is in sweatpants, well, you're not going to come out
gown.
In a negligee.
Yeah.
And you're also not going to wear like, you know, you look like you're going out to dinner and the other person is like,
and
I'm ready
cold.
For Netflix.
We're both always cold. I feel like, you know, we need a pant.
It's true. And a sock.
Yeah.
Like a pant is at least a little more alluring if you've got a foot, but I never have a foot because I need a sock.
That's true. Some skin showing.
Some skin showing. Like, yeah, we were just talking about wearing Goop Glow, you know, the luminizer for like holiday parties and people are like, it's so good because it gives you like this candlelit glow kind of thing, and you're wearing like a strappy dress, and I'm like, holiday party where I'm wearing a strappy dress.
I know.
I would freeze.
How you can. Yeah, that is a certain type of person.
Yeah.
But then, I do agree it gives you a nice glow for sure.
Yeah. But then the at home, like I'm racking my brain for the inappropriate outfit for going outside that's not like, you know, a negligee.
Yeah.
Where you're in bed, where you could be warm.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I asked Jesse about this.
Okay.
And I was like,
what did he say?
I told him about our interview with Helen Fisher. And I was like, do you think I'm like secretly gross in my sweatpants every day? And he was like, no, I like when you look cozy. Which now that I'm thinking about it is like a totally non-committal answer. Do you know what I mean?
I mean,
Like, cozy isn't, like, attractive. You know?
I mean, it's,
like,
it's the worst thing, trying to get someone to say, like, I like you when, like, yeah, blah, blah, blah. All I do is torture my poor boyfriend being like, do you like this outfit? And he's like, I like all your outfits. And I'm like, that's not an answer.
The worst answer.
Not an answer. And I'm sure Helen Fisher would say, stop bothering them and cherish them.
Yeah. And get out of your sweatpants.
And get out of your sweatpants.
That's what she'd say to us.
There needs to be something in between athleisure.
What about a house coat? Like, my mom wears a house coat, but I feel like you could do, like, a chic house coat.
Well, I've been trying.
Or, like, a muumuu that's, like, chic.
I have a really long silk skirt that I wear that I think is sexy, but I don't think has any effect on my partner.
Wait, the pink one?
Yep.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, but
I feel like you get a lot of compliments on that outfit when you wear it to the office.
True. And I can wear it at home with, like, some socks and a sweater.
I like that.
Yeah.
With a sweater. That's perfect.
I'm glad you're appreciating because
I get not that I'm at your house.
But anyway, it gave me, like, she just gave me so much to think about. Like,
yeah.
I kind of loved the idea that 50% of both men and women who had one night stands were using the hookup to actually
find
have.
Love.
Yeah. To, like, further the relationship.
Yeah.
Like, I've.
That it really seems surprised
hard
me.
To believe, but she was, they had, I forget
men
how many
women.
People, men and women,
it's,
yeah.
That was crazy. It's just sort of like where we want to find love.
Yeah.
Most of us. Like, that's kind of a crazy concept and heartening.
Yeah, it is heartening because you think of it as just, as people, I almost think of now, especially with online dating, where people are going through phases where they're like, I am, you know, not committing at this time.
Uh-huh.
And, you know. And then they go to a different phase and they're like, oh, now I'm committing. You know, maybe they switch apps. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I like that.
Looking for love instead of just sex is kind of heartening.
Yeah.
Although I guess it's not so terrible to look for sex.
No, it's not terrible.
But.
Also how pictures of men holding dogs were like,
because they were able to take
engagement.
Care of something. Yeah.
Yeah. That's
yeah.
so fun. It taps into the like biology of what we're always thinking about in the back of our head.
Yeah. And I think that's also just like, yeah, if someone can't take care of a dog, they probably are not going to be too good at maintaining a relationship.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a good test, I guess.
But I might look at a dog and be like, oh, I'm going to have to be chasing after poop
yeah.
the rest of my days. But then what would you think if you saw a guy with a cat?
Weird. Yeah. I don't know about a cat. Yeah. That would be telling. Like, more telling for some reason.
Yeah, I don't know. I certainly wouldn't want to see with a ferret, even
or
though I think
bunny.
Ferrets are cute.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going down a road.
Yeah, too
An
too
online
far.
Dating road. Certainly what you're attracted to seems to change, you know, even though what Helen has to say about, you know, that you have to have a waist-to-hip ratio, and it seems like what you're attracted to changes over time.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, have you found that? Like,
yeah, I'm trying to think. No, I feel like I've always been attracted to, like, a skatery type. Skatery, surfery looking.
Skatery, surfery. That's appealing.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I have always liked that. It's always turned my head.
I don't have an always.
A long hair?
I mean, I always think, like, the person I'm with now, if somebody had showed me a picture of him in high school, I'd be like, oh, my God, my future is so good.
Definitely. That's definitely true. You guys are, like, the most attractive couple.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
With the best hair. Like,
and,
flowing hair, both
and
of you.
You are the couple with the longest, most attractive limbs.
Oh, my God.
Striding into the – anyway. It's just funny to think that, you know, she sees so much of what – were attracted to as biological.
Yeah,
and yet we think of it as like a free will choice sort of thing.
Yeah.
I also, I thought a lot about how much time like women spend getting ready versus men.
Yeah.
Even if they're looking for love in their hookup, they still are like, yeah, I just woke up like this.
Yeah.
Live with it.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Yeah, what is that about? It's true. I think we need to spend less time.
I guess. Except that, you know, you put on some glowy skin item and you're feeling good.
Yeah, that's true. So on Goop, we've got our columns, Megan Tries It and Ask Jean, and we get a whole bunch of beauty questions.
And we love answering them.
So if anyone listening has a question they want us to answer, just send it over to Goop on Instagram or Facebook.
It can be about makeup, hair, skincare, perfume, routines, order of products, techniques, anything.
Okay, this is from Cindy N. Is there a cream that really gets rid of wrinkles?
Okay. It's the number one question I like get over the course of my beauty career. That and also what gets rid of acne. But what's the thing that gets rid of wrinkles? And you're like, obviously, if there was such a thing, you would already know about it.
Yeah, because, oh my God.
Because everybody would be using it. I mean, there's no cream that gets rid of wrinkles. Botox temporarily gets rid of wrinkles. You can also kind of temporarily get rid of wrinkles, not even kind of, from the Jillian Dempsey.
Oh, yeah, the gold bar.
It's a vibrating roller, and like it like lifts. I don't know that it gets rid of wrinkles, but it temporarily lifts your face. And certainly, like if you have under eye bags, it's amazing. I used it this morning.
Definitely.
Then the other thing to consider is that moisturizer in general temporarily gets rid of wrinkles. It plumps up the skin around the wrinkle, so it is much less noticeable. And so that's mostly where you get a lot of the, you know, lessens the appearance of fine lines kind of thing. But it really works.
Yeah, it really does.
And that's a reason why, say, you know, makeup artists always put eye cream on right before they put on concealer or any eye makeup, because they want to plump up your skin so it looks its like fresh best.
Yeah.
And if you keep moisturizing all the time, you will look noticeably less wrinkled.
Yeah.
And your skin, you know, hopefully it helps your skin stay a little more elastic, but who knows?
And SPF every day.
Yeah. Oh, good point. Got it. There is one cream that prevents wrinkles.
That would probably be the closest.
That's the closest thing. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. I love, what's your favorite SPF?
I love Vivasana, the serum crema.
Oh, I love that
it's
name.
It's like, serum, I know, crema. Isn't it so pretty?
It's so good.
It's just like instant gleamy skin. Like sometimes I put it on and wear it out at night.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So good.
And definitely for plane rides.
Yeah. Plane rides, like, you should always wear SPF because you're way up closer to the sun.
Yeah. True.
And less atmosphere in between you and the sun, and definitely the back of your hands on a plane.
I'm bad at doing that.
I love Organic Pharmacy, the SPF 50.
That's
it just like goes in so easily for a clean mineral sunscreen. It's like freaking miracle.
You like 50 more than 30?
Of Organic Pharmacy? Yeah. I mean, I use it on my hands and then I'll use it on my face and my body, you know, if I'm going like on the beach or on a plane or something. But like for every day, I use Dew Skin from Beauty Counter SPF 20. But yeah, you're so right, Megan. Sunscreen, mineral sunscreen, not chemical sunscreen, is the wrinkle prevention cream. There we go. That's a good one.
Thanks again for joining us on The Beauty Closet. You can learn more about our new podcast series at goop.com/beautycloset podcast. We hope you'll come back next Wednesday for our next chat. And in the meantime, just tap subscribe to keep up with new episodes. If you're liking what you're hearing, please rate and review the podcast. And share it with a friend. Talk soon.